The more I think about it, the more I wonder if Paul's apathy at seeing Dodson was merely a front, aimed at covering up a hope he doesn't dare to express. However it unfolds, I have the feeling that tonight will be significant. The reading is at 7, and I have a lot of work to get through if I'm to make it on time. No sooner have I emerged from my meeting, however, than Ish descends on me.
"Oh, Claude,"
she cries and throws her arms around me. "What is it? What's wrong?" My first thought is that she has been sacked.
"It's the island,"
she sobs.
"What island?"
"Kankamauka."
"Oh," I say, relaxing somewhat, then remembering and looking concerned again. "What's happened?" Ish tells me that following our conversation the other morning, she decided she would look into the possibility of a transfer after all. In the course of her research, though, she came across a recent Greenpeace report that put Kokomoko near the top of its list of places most endangered by rising seas.
"Every day it's getting worse,"
she says, eyes and nose streaming.
"The islanders can't fish because the Turbondo government sold the rights to some European consortium, and now there's nothing left in the ocean and they have to buy their food from sodding Australia. But they don't have any money, and the only thing they have to sell is the sand off their beaches. They've been exporting sand by the ton, principally to Turbondo, whose success as an international tax haven has led to a construction boom. But the mining of their own coastline, already at risk from global warming, leaves them perilously exposed. They're literally digging their own graves. The report says the next king tide could wipe them out."
"Who's king tide?"
Kevin says, arriving on the scene.
"It's not a who,"
Ish says as she launches into a complicated account of perigees and perihelions, alignments of sun and moon that could bring about the 20-centimeter rise in sea level that would be enough to swamp the island. Her eyes are white, and I think again of that strange conversation a few days ago when she claimed she was just having a moan.
"We have to do something,"
she says. Kevin and I look at each other. "Do something? Like what?"
"We should tell Porter,"
Ish says, then to our goggling faces.
"BOT is the biggest employer in the whole archipelago. Don't you think he'd want to know?"
"But what's that got to do with him?"
"He can't just stand there with his arms folded while they all drown, can he?"
"In fairness, Ish,"
Kevin offers,
"it's not like they'd actually drown. Obviously, if the islands actually started sinking, the UN or somebody would airlift them out of there."
Ish looks from one of us to the other.
"Christ,"
she exclaims and marches away.
"She's not really going to go bothering blankly with that stuff, is she?"
Kevin says. "She's just having a bad day," I say.
"I bet they're wishing now they hadn't spent all their time faffing about swapping shells."
"Get back to work," I tell him. I go to the bookshop alone. Paul has informed me that he won't be attending the reading itself as a matter of principle, although he also tells me that if I run into his editor before he gets there, I should say he's gone to the men's room. The shop is packed almost to bursting. A pyramid of Ararats is stacked for sale by the till, but most of the audience are already clutching their own copies to their breasts. No one is talking about asset prices or bond yields or basis points. Nobody is promising to crush or rape or dismember some absent third party. Excitement bubbles in the air, and I am just wishing Paul were here to experience it for himself, when on the other side of the room, like an orchid emerging from the thick jungle foliage, I spy Ariadne. She has come directly from work. Her hair is tied back, and flowery fingerprints smudge the lapels of her parka. In the ecstatic atmosphere, my first impulse is to go and talk to her, but then my eyes light on the rangy gaucho by her side, and the happy glow in my heart is extinguished. So this is Oscar. It is little consolation to see he looks exactly like I imagined him, tall, austere, bristling with being. They are not speaking, but his silence is voluminous. In fact, his mere presence seems scandalously sexual. I lower my hand and withdraw to the shadows. Maybe I should invest in Paul's startup after all, I reflect glumly. Watching from a distance is probably as close as a lot of people come to love. If you overlook the exploitation aspect, it is actually a very good idea. The room is full now. Late arrivals are being turned away, and as the clock ticks to the hour, the chatter becomes simultaneously feverish and hushed. Two booksellers arrive at the threshold and, not without difficulty, begin to clear a path through the bodies, following a few paces behind them to a thrill of silence from the assembly, like an inverted cheer. Come the editor I met this afternoon, a willowy, platinum-blonde girl, a red-faced man with tortoise-shell glasses, and lastly, a rustle of delight now, Bimal Banerjee, short, with a tight, pugilistic frame, a bald head and an air of not-suffering fools. Microphones are adjusted, water poured. Banerjee stands to the side, glowering at his feet, as one of the booksellers makes a stammering introduction. Finally, to rapturous applause, the writer takes the podium. He presses his lips together, fiddling with a button on his cuff and darting skeptical glances at the adoring crowd. At last, the bookseller raises his hand for silence. The noise abates, the author leans into the microphone and utters, "Word." We, the listeners, nod to ourselves. It is the first word of the novel's first New York section, set in the roiling heat of the summer of 2001, and following the book's rodent narrator, the hip-hop-loving would-be MC Jeffot, as he attempts to overcome ratism and master flow in order to take part in a human's only freestyle battle, which will be the first step on the path to becoming a chart-topping cross-species sensation. There is literally not a sound as Banerjee reads, until very near the end when a man appears in the door and, although there is patently no room for an extra body, proceeds to insinuate himself into the crowd with a great amount of rustling and drawing a wake of disapproving mutters from those whose view he has impeded and cries from those whose toes he has evidently stood on. I deliberately refrain from looking in his direction, but there is no doubt in my mind as to who it is. 3 or 4 minutes later, he hoves up behind me, smelling of rain and alcohol and still contriving to rustle, even though he is now standing quite still.
"Don't think anyone noticed me,"
he whispers heavily in my ear.
"Shh,"
hisses a nearby woman.
"Well, a lot of people here,"
Paul murmurs, unzipping his raincoat.
"Will you be quiet?"
a man says severely. Paul holds up his hands pacifically, and we address ourselves to the speaker again. But he has quit the lectern, and the bookseller has retrieved the microphone to thank us for coming. I feel a surge of irritation at Paul, especially when he starts to tell me how bourgeois and derivative Bimal Banerjee's reading was.
"You didn't even hear it. You arrived 2 minutes from the end."
"That was enough, Claude. The guy's a hack, a total hack."
Over the happy din, the bookseller announces that the author will be signing copies of his novel, and the crowd immediately redistributes itself into a long, snaking line.
"You're not going to..." "Oh, for God's sake,"
Paul says, rolling his eyes as I join the end. As we shuffle forward, though, he falls silent and his face becomes somber. This is the life he could have had, or something like it. Looking at him sidelong, I wonder again if he cares more than he lets on. Has he really just come for a free meal, or is he hoping that his editor's interest was not in fact a formality, that this could be a doorway back into the world he abandoned? As we draw close to the top of the line, I see that the editor and the willowy blonde girl have gathered by the low table where Banerjee is signing books.
"Here comes the Inquisition,"
Paul mutters in my ear.
"Better act like you enjoyed it."
"I did enjoy it,"
I am about to retort, but now, as we step to the top of the line, Paul wrests the book from my hands.
"Towering reading," he says to Banerjee. "Truly triumphant."
"You made it,"
Robert Dodson exclaims.
"Bimal, allow me to introduce Paul, an old friend of mine."
"Didn't I see you come in at the end?"
Bimal Banerjee narrows his eyes.
"No, that wasn't me,"
Paul says.
"Could you make this out to Paul and Claude?"
"Ah, yes, forgive me,"
the editor says, ushering me into the circle.
"This is Claude, Paul's partner."
I want to protest, but the proximity of the famous author has rendered me speechless. He passes the book back to me, his black eyes glittering over me like an entomologist's over a bug.
"Thank you,"
I attempt to say, but it comes out,
"Pancake."
The blonde girl is called Ariel. She is Dodson's editorial assistant, very beautiful with enormous amethyst eyes, though the red rim suggests she has been crying not so long ago. Paul appears quite taken with her. So does Banerjee, who keeps shooting her glances that oscillate from amorous to hostile.
And this, of course, is William O'Hara, our very kind host for tonight, Dodson says as we are joined by the man in tortoiseshell glasses who is wearing a florid, raffishly underbuttoned shirt that gives him the look of an aging dandy.
Oh, what a great pleasure!
Paul clasps O'Hara's hand.
I adore your work.
I feel like I know your face, O'Hara says, wagging a finger at him. Didn't you write a book once?
A Youthful Folly,
Paul says modestly, though it is clear he is pleased.
The best kind,
William O'Hara says.
How many did we sell?
Bimal Banerjee asks Dodson. The editor goes to consult with the bookseller, then comes back with a figure. Bimal Banerjee receives it expressionlessly.
Cretins,
he says, though whether he is referring to those who bought the book, those who didn't, or indeed to us, is not immediately plain.
From the doorway, I see Ariadne waving to me.
There is no sign of the gaucho. Affixing what I intend as an avuncular smile, I go over.
Look at you talking to the famous writer, she says. He's a friend of yours?
No, no, I say. I'm just going to have dinner with him.
Huh?
She says, eyeing me speculatively.
Did you enjoy the reading?
I say, adding casually in the hope that it will sound like a natural extension of the original question and not make her wonder, for example, how I know his name. You are here with Oscar? She laughs.
No, this is not Oscar's kind of thing at all. He will be bored after 5 minutes.
I permit myself a tiny dose of schadenfreude at this sliver of incompatibility and adjust my position so that the signed Banerjee is on view.
So, how are you? Your father?
He is much better, thank you. But I have been thinking about you these days.
Huh?
I confine myself to an arch of an eyebrow, although she might as well have set off an atomic bomb inside my head.
Yes, I want to ask you about something. Last week the landlord has called and said he is going to put up the rent of the Ark. Not just put it up, he's going to double it. The manager has told him no one's spending money right now, our take is down 30%, there's no way we can pay this much extra. But he just says 1st of October rent goes up, so now we have to...
She looks so sad. As she goes on, I find myself lost in a fantasy in which I stride into the Ark with a holdall full of money, which I pour onto the counter to tears of gratitude from Ariadne, while in the sky outside, Oscar's Médecins Sans Frontières helicopter explodes in a fireball and drops in hissing shrapnel into the river.
Think we should do?
She says. The iridescent eyes wait on me expectantly. I jolt from my reverie. What did she ask me exactly?
I begin. Well,
that depends.
Darling?
I am being tapped on the shoulder. I turn to find Paul there with Robert Dodson beside him.
We're leaving for Williams now.
Oh, I see. I suppose I should be thankful to him for getting me off the hook.
Come along, dear. We'll be late,
he says. Ariadne is looking from me to Paul and back again with evident confusion. I raise my eyebrows at her in a way that is intended to connote that I am not actually this man's homosexual lover. I am merely pretending in the hope that this will help reunite him with his editor. But this just makes her more confused. I tell her I will come into the Ark next week and talk to her more about it, then hurry after the others. William O'Hara's house is close by, so we set off on foot. The evening is mild and the rain has thinned to a fine drizzle, although Bimal Banerjee walks with his shoulders hunched and the lapels of his jacket clutched to his throat as if it bore him some mortal intent.
Hey, Claude.
Paul pulls me back into a doorway.
We need to get this partner thing straight, he says.
I agree, I say, still annoyed with him for embarrassing me in front of Ariadne. The fiasco has gone on long enough. Do you want to tell them or will I?
Tell them what?
Well, the truth. Isn't that what you mean?
The truth? That I'm a washed-up loser with nothing to show for the last 7 years but a mortgage in arrears and a wife who hates my guts. Why would I want to tell them that?
Because it's true.
Jesus, what is it with you and the truth? Can you stop banging that drum for 5 seconds and just think? Think about the opportunity I have here.
The word arrests me. I lock my eyes on his, and he gazes back at me desperately before continuing in a quieter voice.
These are really influential people, Claude. This could really help me, I promise, down the line. I'll explain everything, but for now...
all right,
I say, secretly thrilled. Although only on the condition you don't talk about our relationship unless it's totally necessary. I am not so good at lying as you.
Fantastic. I really appreciate it.
He coughs awkwardly.
There's just one more small thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to be clear that I'm the one who... you know...
What?
Who? Oh, come on, you know.
I'm afraid I don't.
Well, okay, I'm the one who, so to speak, goes on top.
Who goes on top?
Yes.
You wanted to be clear that whenever we have sexual intercourse in our imaginary relationship, you are the one who goes on top?
Yes.
Why?
I just prefer it. I just feel more comfortable if it were made clear that I'm the one on top.
I roll my eyes and move back onto the path.
Okay, look, we don't have to tell people, but just so we agree ourselves that that's the way it is. Trust me, even if you don't use the details, it's better to have your characters' backstories fully mapped out. That's an old writing tip.
We catch up with the others in a beautiful Georgian square, at the center of which is a small, damply verdant park where cherry trees sway beneath the arms of a magnificent oak and golden light glows from Narnian lampposts. Even the traffic noise here seems less frenetic, more polite. It is like being in a different city, in a different century, perhaps even on a different, kinder planet.
How does he afford this place?
Paul murmurs as O'Hara mounts the steps to a red brick on the western side. I shrug. He must have sold a lot of books. Our host ushers us inside and down a hall until we find ourselves in an exquisite dining room. A chandelier shimmers above us, silver gleams from the sideboard, every detail bespeaks comfort and hospitality. It is here, nevertheless, that we encounter our first setback. Two more guests are seated at the long rosewood table. O'Hara makes the introductions. The tall, slightly gaunt woman with the scintillating black eyes is Victoria Galahad, a literary agent. And this, of course... He extends a hand to the large, jolly-looking character squeezed not entirely successfully into a wispy ecru dress.
Is Mary Cutlass.
Mary Cutlass. The same critic who eviscerated Paul's novels 7 years ago. She shows no sign of recognition, merely flashes us a quick, heavy-mandibled smile and returns to her conversation. Paul, on the other hand, looks like he is about to faint. I swear under my breath, and on the pretext of fetching something from his coat, pull him back out into the hall. Are you all right? I ask him. His face is parchment white.
I'm fine,
he insists. I've just never seen her in the flesh before. I'm a little surprised she actually has flesh. I always pictured her as a sort of floating skull.
It's not a big deal,
I say. She gave you a bad review, so what? This was a long time ago. You must not let her ruin your night.
I'm telling you, I'm fine.
Your hands are shaking.
You haven't heard the stories I've heard.
He blurts, the facade of indifference crumbling.
That woman is evil, Claude, evil. I heard about one writer she did a hatchet job on. He sent a whole package of anthrax to her office. When she opened it up, the anthrax died. She killed that anthrax stone dead, Claude, with a look. That's the kind of person you're dealing with.
What can I do except put my hand on his shoulder and tell him that I'll be here to help him in whatever way I can? We return to the dining room and sit down across the table from Dodson and Victoria Galahad.
William and I go back years.
The editor is explaining to Mary Cutlass.
When I'm in Dublin, I often stay with him.
Asterisk saves money wherever it can.
Bimal Banerjee comments from the far end of the table.
Who's hungry?
Another man, wearing a paisley apron over a striped shirt, has whirled into the room bearing a samovar of aromatic soup.
Ha, bellissima.
O'Hara rejoices.
Everyone may I present my other half.
Better half, some would say.
The new man interjects.
Crispin O'Connell. Younger half, without question.
This Crispin remarks.
I see you made it out of bed at last, Mia Karina.
Oh, I had nothing to do there once the paperboy left,
Crispin rejoins to a mock scandalized gasp from O'Hara.
How wicked.
Ha! Paul says.
My Claude's exactly the same, aren't you, Claude? Ah, bellissima,
as Crispin serves him soup. Everyone falls too, though Paul still appears on edge and eats little.
So tell us, Robert, what does Asterisk have in the pipeline?
Asks Victoria Galahad.
Well, we're publishing the autobiography of Jean-Pierre Lettrefitz, Dodson says, then explains to the rest of us. He was CFO at Credit Flanders, then special advisor to the Mitterrand government, before heading the EU Commission's task force on banking reform. Now he's president of the International Credit Fund.
And what's his book called?
O'Hara asks.
It's called Who Da Man, Dodson says.
And how's Jean-Pierre?
Crispin says.
You know Jean-Pierre.
Victoria sparkles.
I took an economics seminar with him at Oxford.
Crispin says.
You were at Oxford?
Dodson says.
That's where we met.
Crispin says, folding O'Hara's hand in his.
Bellissima.
Paul interjects from the edge of the conversation.
Robert and I were both at Oxford as well, Victoria explains.
Though sadly the only sparks were at the Debating Society,
Dodson adds to a flick of her scarf.
And of course Bemal was there too some years after us at Jesus, wasn't it, Banerjee?
Magdalene. Banerjee says into his soup, although its homophone would be an apte sobriquet. Laughs Paul.
I hear that.
Stop interrupting, I mutter, nudging him under the table.
What? I'm just joining in the conversation.
You're embarrassing me, I say.
What about you, William?
The agent turns to our host. It's a dreadful question to ask an author, but can we look forward to new work from you anytime soon?
As a matter of fact, I'm just putting the finishing touches to a novel,
O'Hara says.
Set in the slums of Dublin's inner city, I call it The Phoenixer.
Oh, bravo, Victoria says. I know you probably hate to talk about
it. It's the tale of a boy.
O'Hara rests his wrists on the table and raises his head like a medium at a seance, as though addressing his response to some invisible interlocutor hovering above the door.
A simple boy named Whacker, who is born into one of those disgusting, scabrous tenements, and it's simply his life, you know, in this dreadful place as he struggles to get by with only his penny whistle and his beloved donkey for company. My goodness,
Victoria says.
It sounds terribly moving.
It is moving.
O'Hara nods.
And I say that without arrogance because I very quickly stop thinking of it as mine. It's Whacker's book. It's his story. He simply made a gift of it to me because I feel he wanted me to tell people what it was like in these hellholes.
Oh, God, you're not chewing everyone's ear off about Whacker, are you? Crispin comes shouldering his way through the door with a tray. Can't I leave you alone for 2 minutes?
I think it's tremendously important that our artists give a voice to these people,
Mary Cutlass avers.
To remind us that they too have feelings and hopes and dreams and aspirations.
Feelings, yes. Whacker certainly has no shortage of those,
Crispin says.
Ever since William began writing his book, it's been, these pedal pushers are just the sort of thing Whacker might wear. This pot noodle is all Whacker might eat for a week. Whacker would understand why these boys broke the antique lantern on the porch.
But he would understand,
O'Hara protests.
A boy like Whacker simply has no concept of antiques.
Those hideous pedal pushers,
Crispin remembers with a shudder.
That was the last straw. I told him, darling, I have no objection to a ménage à trois if it's tidy, but I will not cohabit with culottes. It sounds like a most worthy endeavour,
Mary Cutlass tells O'Hara.
There but for the grace of God,
he replies with a sigh.
The slums of Dublin are like a five-star hotel compared to New Delhi.
Bimal Banerjee sneers.
Yes, but try getting room service after 10 o'clock.
Crispin says. Banerjee has barely tasted his food, although he is making inroads into the wine. Instead, he occupies himself staring across the table at Ariel, the editorial assistant, who blushes into her soup bowl as if the bisque were making improper suggestions to her. Attempting to draw him into the conversation or distract him from whatever episode is unfolding or not unfolding, Robert Dodson clears his throat and says, "I should have mentioned before, Bemal, Paul here is a writer too. In fact, we published his first novel 7 years ago."
"My condolences," Banerjee says, swiveling his heavy-lidded eyes on Paul.
Marie Cutlass brings her finger to her lip and away again.
"Yes, I think I remember a thing about...
Paul issues her a watery smile.
"And what have you been doing since, Paul?"
Victoria asks.
"Working on another novel?" "Well, Victoria, interesting you should ask me that. No, I'm actually in business these days, and as it happens, I've been working on a proposal you might find..."
"Clowns!" exclaims Mary Cutlass.
"Wasn't it about clowns or something?"
"You're thinking of Bemal's first book," Victoria tells her.
"No, no, it's coming back to me now. Gosh, I think I may even have reviewed it."
She covers her mouth with a beefy hand and twinkles merrily at Paul.
"I hope I didn't say anything too awful."
Paul offers no response to this other than the same thin smile.
"You should feel no regret at having failed as a writer," Banerjee says to Paul. "It is the dying art of a dying civilization."
Paul looks surprised, then his eyes narrow.
"You believe the novel is a dying art?"
Mary Cutlass presses Banerjee.
"I believe art is a dying art," he says. "What we are witnessing in 21st century Western society is nothing less than the death of subjectivity. We are in Dublin, so I will quote to you a Dubliner, George Bernard Shaw, who said that man looks in a mirror to see his face and at art to see his soul, but modern man has no soul to see. He has become little more than a conduit for the transfer of wealth between corporations."
"That seems a bit pessimistic,"
Victoria nods gently, "given that modern man has bought several hundred thousand copies of your book."
"People will always need art,"
William O'Hara declares.
"What is it they say? Art exists to keep the truth from killing us."
"You have to be alive for something to kill you," Banerjee snaps back.
"I don't think that's true."
We all turn. Ariel, the beautiful editorial assistant, blushing a deep pink, lays down her cutlery and speaks tremulously to her plate.
"I just mean..."
Her voice is barely louder than a whisper.
"I think we need art to remind us we're alive, to remind us of the beauty around us and the people around us and that they need us. Sometimes we forget, and that's what kills us."
Hearing this, Banerjee's face utterly transforms. His severe expression disappears, melting into a tragic puppy dog devotion.
"Has anyone read the other books on the shortlist?"
Dodson says hurriedly, as the Indian seems on the point of making some sort of declaration.
"I had a look at the Conway Inchbold title, Antelope Crimes. Really quite impressive. Built up a genuine sense of menace. The antelope itself was bloody terrifying."
"Oh, yes,"
Mary Cutlass agrees.
"The claustrophobic atmosphere, the constant sense of threat, reminiscent of the Russians, Gogol in particular. Don't you adore Gogol?"
she says to Paul.
"I'm more of a Yahoo man myself," Paul says.
Mary Cutlass looks blank.
"Conway Inchbold is a cancer," says Banerjee.
"All right,"
Crispin throws down his napkin.
"I'd like to announce that I've just invented a new rule of etiquette, which is that whoever has cooked the meal gets to choose the topic of conversation, and my decision is no more books."
"What are we supposed to talk about?"
his partner says, looking rather affronted.
"There are several topics available,"
Crispin replies blithely.
"Such as?"
"Well, for starters, I'd like to hear more from this mysterious gentleman,"
Crispin says, and my blood freezes as I realize he means me.
"Who is he? Who are you? You're not a writer, are you?"
"I'm a banker," I say.
"Oh, snap,"
O'Hara exclaims. "You work in finance?" I say to Crispin.
I dabble, that's all. Anyway, I've retired. He says this without irony, though I doubt he is even 40 years old. But before I can ask what he did, he has pointed his fork at Paul and me.
And the two of you are a pair?
Does he suspect? I stare back at him, words dying in my throat.
That's right, Paul steps in. A pair, that's where we are. A pair of men, two men, in a relationship.
And tell us, where did you meet?
In a sauna, Paul says. A gay sauna.
Which one?
Crispin says.
Which one?
Paul says, drumming his fingers and contemplating the chandelier.
Darling, do you remember which one?
No, I say.
It was in San Francisco,
Paul says with a flash of what I suppose we must call inspiration.
I'd gone over for research. Claude was working as a go-go dancer, weren't you, Claude? Claude, weren't you?
Yes, I say through gritted teeth.
He was just out of the French Navy,
Paul continues.
They called him the Ars de Triomphe. Our eyes met in the steam room. Next thing, we fell in love.
Che bello,
William O'Hara says fondly.
Now we do everything together, Paul continues.
It is like watching a runaway train that is pretending to be gay.
Holidays to Sweden to buy furniture, London every year for Fashion Week, the opera.
Crispin pounces on this.
What's your favourite opera?
Paul, put on the spot, goes blank. His mouth opens and closes. The runaway train abruptly comes off the track, and with a certain amount of enjoyment, I watch it fly through the air, wheels spinning fruitlessly.
That would have to be... Mamma Mia?
Crispin and William look at each other in surprise, then dissolve into guffaws.
Us two!
Crispin squeals.
It's our terrible secret. And Paul, did you say that you were working on a business venture?
William inquires.
Yes, William, I did. In fact, it's something you might find Ow!
He looks accusingly at me.
Darling.
You promised you wouldn't discuss business tonight, darling, I say to him.
I'm not discussing business, darling. They asked what I'm doing and I'm telling them. Actually, I think I may have some brochures here somewhere. Ow! Darling, would you please stop kicking me?
Darling, I would like a word with you outside, please.
What's the problem? I'm just... Hey, put that back!
As I snatch away his wine glass. I'll give it back after we've had a little word, I say firmly. Grousing under his breath, Paul gets out of his seat.
Obvious who wears the trousers in your household,
Crispin teases.
I wear the trousers,
Paul rejoins as I bundle him out the door.
And I go on top!
Ignoring his protestations, I propel him down the hall and into a darkened sitting room where we are certain to be out of earshot.
What are you doing?
What are you doing?
Paul returns.
I thought you were going to help me.
I am helping you. I have spent the last 2 hours pretending to be gay, but that was because I thought you were trying to win over your editor. I did not realize that you had constructed this charade in order to bilk our hosts out of their money. This is a word, bilk?
How am I bilking them? I'm just making conversation.
Answer this. Did you come here this evening with the specific intention to drum up investments for my hot's waitress?
You say that like it's a bad thing.
He protests.
My hot waitress is going to be huge, and I'm giving them the chance to get in on the ground floor. I'm basically thrusting millions and millions of euro into their hands, and you're telling me I'm a bad guest?
You told me you had come here to rebuild your relationship with your editor and restart your career.
I said no such thing, Claude. I said they were influential people, and they are. Look at the size of this place. I could move my whole family in here, and it would take those guys about 6 months to notice. They're exactly the kind of investor we need.
That may be so. Nevertheless, I'm informing you now that my part in this deception is over. Paul grinds his fists against his temples.
I don't understand you. You're always on my case about doing something with my life, and then when I try, you're completely unsupportive.
Because I want you to write. And everything you do is just a way of avoiding writing. Don't you understand? You are the great investment opportunity. You have the chance to get in on the ground floor of yourself.
What are you talking about?
Paul exclaims. It is true. This did not come out quite like I thought it would. I am talking about the chance to create a work of art instead of merely adding to the transience and the falsity of our times. You can rise above them, find some meaning within them.
Oh, well, that's just peachy for you, isn't it? I'm sure from your perspective it looks like a great idea to crawl up my own ass, or however you put it.
Get in on the ground floor of yourself.
So you and your banker pals can keep merrily turning the world to shit, and then any time you're feeling bad dragging the poor old artist who'll find some meaning for you. You're like the property developer who spends the year demolishing the countryside, then wants to go on holiday to somewhere completely unspoiled. Well, I'm not your meaning monkey. I'm not here to make you feel better.
That's not what I'm saying.
I'm living in your world, pal. I've got to play by your rules. If I've got to add to the falsity to feed my family, then falsity it is. And for transience, I'll say this for it. At least it's over quick.
Ah, young love.
Comes a voice from behind us. Standing in the doorway, framed by the light of the hall, is William O'Hara. Wine glass perched between finger and thumb like a spheric translucent butterfly.
Crispin and I used to fight like that, he says. Now we're like two old maids making each other tea. But I see you found it.
He nods at the far wall. We turn around. Hanging over the fireplace is a painting. In the gloom it appears to be a rectangle of solid black, but now O'Hara switches on a lamp, and I can see that the darkness is composed of minute inscriptions, accreting here a little more, here a little less, so that shapes seem to emerge, swim about, and disappear again. The effect is surprisingly powerful and quite beautiful.
I wanted to bring the guests in for private viewing, but Crispin thought it would seem like showing off,
O'Hara says.
He doesn't understand that I don't think of it as mine. How could anyone ever believe he owns something as monumental as this?
He gazes up at the painting as if he were speaking to it rather than to us, drifting across the floor towards it like a strand of inverted smoke pulled backwards into the unlit fire.
The instant I saw it, I knew I could spend the rest of my life looking at it. Crispin says that's exactly why he doesn't like it. You never say that about me, he says.
O'Hara smiles.
He's such a silly old duffer.
I recognize the painting. After my failed encounter with Ariadne, I spent many nights online looking at this and others, taking some consolation, if that's the word, from the charred and tortured surfaces like selenographies of some bleak moon.
François Texier, I say.
The philosopher?
Paul is staring up at the painting with a certain amount of misgiving, as if shadowy hands might at any moment emerge from it and pull him in.
That's right, O'Hara says. You probably know the story.
Paul shakes his head.
In the late 1990s, he disappeared, dropped out of contact, left his job at the university. He'd been about to begin work on what was to be his definitive statement. He had a title for it, and indeed a contract, but the years went by and the book never surfaced, and neither did Texier. Instead, these paintings began to appear in Paris, gifts to his friends, many of them strange portraits, strange landscapes, strange abstractions. All very strange, and yet in some way you could see the connection to his thought.
And the book? Paul asks.
What happened to that? Well, this is the book.
O'Hara says, gesturing to the painting.
La marque et le vide. The mark and the void, if you look closely, you can see.
Words. Words upon words upon yet more words. Hundreds of pages of text superimpose one on top of the other, rendering each other utterly illegible, creating instead a cascading darkness that seems to devour the very possibility of meaning.
He wrote it all out, you see, his book, the unfinished book, on the canvas in pen and ink. When he had finished, he burned the transcripts and all his notes and treated the canvas with the soot. And he stipulated that whoever owned it subsequently would have to expose it to smoke, which it's been chemically designed to absorb over time. That's why we've hung it over a fireplace. What happened?
Paul says.
He'd had some kind of breakdown? He'd certainly grown wary of the idea of definitive statements,
O'Hara says.
But in fact, the painting fits his philosophy rather well. The mark
making your mark, this idea that to live in full means to leave some permanent evidence of yourself on the world. He'd become quite suspicious of that. And the corresponding notion that the world is a blank page waiting to be inscribed, a void to be covered up with our doings. No, no. On the contrary, the void comes from inside us, from deep inside us. And the more we try to escape it, the more we turn the world into a mirror of that emptiness. That's what he'd felt he'd done while attempting to come up with his definitive statement.
Dark, Paul says, his eyes still locked on the painting.
Well, that depends on how you look at it. You can transform it, you see. That's the point of art, as he saw it.
Isn't art about making your mark?
In a sense, but art is something you give away. That's the difference. Instead of grabbing up bits of reality for oneself, he became very interested in the tribal cultures of the Pacific. His wife was an anthropologist. He used to travel around Polynesia with her. Anyway, he was very taken with these cycles of exchange they have, whereby objects are passed back and forth through generations and nothing belongs to anyone in perpetuity. Or rather, there is no one for things to belong to. He used to say that in that part of the world, you wrote your address backwards. That is, first you wrote the country, then your town, then your street, and only lastly your name, which, when you think about it, makes much more sense. And art for him was an attempt to write his address backwards, so to speak.
It's so dark, though, Paul says, his eyes still locked on the painting.
Yes, the problem was those very cultures were in danger of being wiped out by all the others busy making their mark.
Climate change.
Travelling around the Pacific, they could already see it happening. That had a powerful effect on him, not just the threat of floods and cataclysm and so on, but the fact that no one in the first world wanted to know. And then when his wife died, that seemed to compound everything. This was painted only a few months before his suicide.
I hadn't known this. I think of Ish and her islanders, and looking at the painting I feel a chill, as if behind the impenetrable black veil I can see drowned faces buried under relentless waves.
Crispin can't stand it,
O'Hara says, returning his gaze to the painting.
He says it's depressing, and what it's done to the insurance is just shocking. They're insisting that we install some sort of ghastly alarm system. It'll be like living in a bank vault. Looking at it makes me feel rather hopeful. There's a sort of comfort in the thought of all of us swimming around in this void together. The notion that our borders are porous makes me feel oddly complete. Like love, I suppose, isn't it? It's when you forget yourself that you're most who you are. And conversely, as Texier said, there's nothing so selfish as the urge to escape ourselves. Crispin can't stand it when I quote him either,
he concludes apologetically. And then, as a voice calls from elsewhere in the house,
"Dessert!"
he says.
"Come."
Back in the dining room, the conversation has turned to the banking crisis.
"Oh Lord, not again," O'Hara says.
"When you cook the dinner, you can choose the topics,"
Crispin tells him primly.
"That Miles O'Connor is the worst of the lot,"
Mary Cutlass says with an access of anger.
"I don't understand how he hasn't been driven from the city."
"Oh, Miles isn't so bad,"
Crispin says as he portions out cake.
"He helped us out of a hole when all the other banks were being beastly." "Who is it you work for again?"
He directs this last question at me. "BOT," I tell him, "or Agron Torabundo, as it is now." He is impressed.
"Ever since old Blankley took over, you boys have been raking it in. Funny, he always struck me as a bit of a maverick. It just goes to show, I suppose."
He digs into his dessert.
"And now you've got this hedge fund. What's the chap's name again?"
"Howie," I say. "Howard Hogan."
"This thing's only been going a few weeks," Crispin informs the table. "But it's taken off like a rocket. I wish I knew how he does it."
He returns to me.
"I've tried to work out his system, but I can't make head or tail of it."
"Non-linear maths," I say, then confess, "I don't understand it either. There's a Russian."
Mary Cutlass, who has been looking increasingly baffled by this conversation, breaks in.
"What I would like to know is, when are our writers going to address the banking crisis?"
"I do address it in my new book,"
William tells her.
"Whacker's elderly grandmother has her apple cart repossessed by the bank. Of course, those people don't have a clue how to run an apple cart."
"I mean the whole thing, what it's done to society and so on. There must be a great novel to be written about that."
"The banking crisis is unrepresentable,"
Banerjee says severely.
These people are not even human.
Guilty as charged,
Crispin says with a sigh.
They've done some terrible things,
Victoria Galahad intervenes.
Still, I don't know if it's a good idea to go around calling them inhuman.
This is their own doing,
Banerjee insists.
Worse, their vacuous thinking has spread out of the world of finance like an epidemic. Now people are barely capable of sustaining a genuine emotion or communicating anything more complex than pictures of cats, cat pictures and pornography. That is what we have now instead of art, excuse me.
With that, he gets up and leaves the room.
Probably going to hang himself, Crispin says once the door closes.
Is he always like that?
William inquires.
Oh, he's probably just a bit tired, that's all.
Robert Dodson says vaguely,
misses his wife.
Ariel begins to cough as if her cake has gone down the wrong way, but she quickly recovers and, perhaps taking advantage of Banerjee's absence, inclines herself over the table towards Paul, rather like a flower bowing under the weight of a raindrop.
I meant to tell you earlier, she confides. I adored For Love of a Clown.
Paul, who since our conversation in the dining room has been subdued, starts up, blinking in surprise.
Hey,
he says.
Your novel.
Ariel, who evidently is used to conversing with writers, explains.
Oh, what, really? I reread it recently.
She elaborates. She speaks in a soft, low voice that makes everything she says sound like a confession of love.
That line about how we're all clowns in love's circus, tumbling through sawdust in clothes that don't fit us, waiting for the day we can wipe off our false smiles. Gosh, just so perfect.
Thank you,
Paul says, seeming to expand before my very eyes.
Thank you so much. Are you working on something new?
She asks.
I know you said you'd started a business, but there is a new book on the way, isn't there? I've been waiting such a long time.
Paul says, staring into her eyes, which are almost indecently huge and open like lilies in bloom, petals spread, pollen-flecked pistils exposed to the elements.
Well, I have been tinkering with something, on and off.
Oh.
Ariel applauds softly.
Really?
Robert Dodson has been listening in.
A novel?
Paul looks back and forth from his former editor to his former editor's sublime assistant. In this instance, at least, beauty defeats truth.
Yes,
he says.
Can you tell us what it's about?
Ariel asks.
I'd prefer not to go into it at this stage.
Just give us an idea, Dodson encourages.
What's this?
William inquires.
Paul's telling us about his novel.
Oh, a new one.
A word,
Dodson says.
The Bare Bones.
Victoria Galahad, Mary Cutlass and the others are all craned forward on their elbows, as though to catch the words as soon as they appear. Paul looks increasingly panic-stricken.
It's about...
Tell them what you told me the first day we met. I encourage him. He looks round at me wildly. About the bank, all that.
Right, he says. Exactly. It's about a banker working in an investment bank in the IFSC.
Just what we've been talking about,
Mary Cutlass notes.
So you don't think it's unrepresentable?
Robert Dodson says with a smile.
With all due respect to Bemal,
William puts in,
I don't think you can just write off a whole swathe of the modern world like that.
Exactly, Paul says. The way I see it, it's the writer's job to try to find the meaning in it, find the humanity in people like Claude here, and if it's not there, to try to understand where it's gone.
Hear, hear,
William says.
Well said.
Victoria Galahad smiles.
Ariel just gazes at him as though from the bed of a swoon.
What's it called?
Mary Cutlass says.
Call,
Paul repeats.
You must have a title, a working title at least.
Of course,
Paul says a little hoarsely as the table's eyes swivel onto him again.
It's called,
anal analyst.
There is a moment of silence.
Anal analyst?
Dodson says, trying it out.
Anal analyst?
Mary Gutless repeats to herself.
Well, it's certainly memorable,
O'Hara concludes. He's a pufter, is he? Crispin asks. Your banker. He's gay, he's been promiscuous, as so many of us have, Paul improvises. But now all that meaningless sex turns out to have a consequence, a terrible consequence. And in his isolated world of money and accumulation, he doesn't have the tools, as it were, to deal with it. The heads around the table nod solemnly.
It sounds fascinating,
Dodson says.
Has anybody seen it?
To be honest, Robert, I'm trying to keep it quiet for now. You know, focus on the writing, get the book finished before the whole market frenzy takes over.
That's wise,
Dodson agrees.
Still, if you wanted to give me an outline or just a general chat, Bimal and I are going back to London tomorrow, but we'll be here again for the Black and White Festival in a couple of weeks. William's going to be doing an interview with him.
I'd like that, Robert. Paul replies, I'd like that very much.
You would be better off setting fire to your manuscript and throwing the ashes in the Liffey than publishing it with Asterisk Press.
Acoustic voice behind us signals that Bimal Banjari has returned. And if you have been bewitched by the whore of Bloomsbury here, I should warn you that she can never deliver on her false promises because she is a creature made entirely of ice.
My dear, I don't think you need to worry about any of us running off with your woman,
Crispin says, leaning back in his chair.
But I can't say I haven't wondered if you're going to finish that cake.
The party winds down shortly after midnight. Robert Dodson explains apologetically that he and his author have an early flight tomorrow. As we leave, William promises to send tickets for the upcoming festival, and Dodson repeats his offer of a private meeting. Walking down the street, Paul seems buoyant. Is it just that he's enjoyed two free meals today? Or something more?
Well, Claude, he says after a while, we didn't snag any investors. Still, I suppose I should thank you for not letting the cat out of the bag.
You're welcome, I say. I enjoyed the evening very much. At the dinner parties I usually go to, everyone just talks about golf.
Yeah, writers don't play much golf, though mostly because they can't afford the green fees. Otherwise, they'd never pass up an opportunity to procrastinate like that.
Is that right?
Probably that's why the clubs keep the sub so high, because they don't want the place clogged up with writers day and night.
We walk a little further, and then, as it doesn't seem that he will raise it himself...
Anal analyst, I say.
That was all I could think of, he says apologetically.
Still, it does not seem to have done any harm, I say. I mean, your editor still wants to see it.
He doesn't reply. I don't understand. Why is he so determined to downplay what has happened?
He wants to meet you and talk about it. This is a big opportunity, no?
Anal analyst doesn't exist, remember? I just said that to get him off my case.
But it's a positive sign, isn't it?
A sign of what? You think he's going to pay big money for a novel that I just made up?
Aren't all novels made up?
Paul rolls his eyes.
I'm serious, I persist. If you know he likes the idea, why not try to write the book?
Books don't pay, Claude. I've got a family to support.
How can you say they don't pay? Look at the house we have just been in with a Tixier on the wall worth €500,000.
Paul comes to a stop there on the street.
€500,000? For that thing?
More after the retrospective in New York next year.
€500,000.
He puts his head in his hands.
I can't believe you stopped me from bilking them.
Aha! You admit it, you were trying to bilk them.
I was bilking them into making the best financial decision of their lives. With that kind of money behind it, there's no way My Hot's Waitress could have failed. We could all have been rich and had hideous paintings in our living rooms and had living rooms.
That's not the point. The point is that it is still possible to support yourself and your family by writing. And now there may be a chance to do so. Why not take it?
Haven't we discussed this?
Yes, but you have never given me a plausible answer.
He lets out a gasp of exasperation.
Because I don't like being reminded I'm obsolete. How about that for starters?
But if you write the truth about our time, how can the truth ever be obsolete?
People don't want the truth,
he says, waving his hands at the streets around us.
They want better quality lies. High-definition lies on 50-inch screens. I wrote a damn truth already, Claude. Maybe I didn't write it well, but I wrote it. And not only did no one want to see it, they made me feel like a fool for even trying. They laughed out the window at me as they sped away on the gravy train.
That was during the boom. Now the gravy train has stopped.
Yeah, well, I can't unsee what I saw.
The money poured in and it was like suddenly everyone in Ireland took off their masks and they were these horrific, rapacious alien beings who, if you fell down in the street, would just leave you there to die.
Maybe it was the rapacious alien that was the mask. And now they need someone to help them find their true faces again.
He doesn't reply to this. I pace alongside him for a moment, considering what he has said. Then slowly I nod in agreement. No, you're right. It's just as Banerjee said, the world we live in has fallen too far to be saved by art.
It's not as Banerjee said,
Paul objects. It's got nothing to do with Banerjee. Of course not. I only mean that his point was well made, that in this environment you should not feel bad to have failed as a writer. For a second time, Paul stops in the street.
Failed as a writer? Can you believe he said that?
Although in some ways it is a shame, I reflect. Robert was very excited to read your new work. Paul mumbles ambiguously. And his assistant as well, I note. The mutterings take on a more wistful cast. She certainly seemed to prefer your writing to Banerjee's, I observe. There is a turbulent silence, and then Paul blurts, Look, I'll be honest, there are times when I wish I hadn't spent 7 years playing online poker and stalking waitresses, but to write a book, to go back into that world.
He just wanted to see a proposal,
I urge him.
It will only be 1 or 2 weeks of work, and I can help you. Listen to your ideas, check the spelling, whatever it takes.
It's not that simple. I'm in debt, Claude. I owe money left and right. I can't just drop everything to go and write a novel. What would you be dropping, I say?
The website!
Oh yes, of course.
If my hut's waitress were up and running, it'd be a different story, he says. I know I had some money coming in, but we're at a crucial stage right now. We need to find investors. If I walk away, the whole thing will just collapse.
How can the same mind that produced For Love of a Clown have come up with My Hot's Waitress?
How can he not see the difference between the two? Is this simply the artistic personality?
But it's true. I have no right to criticize until I have put some skin in the game. If you want, I tell him, I will speak to my clients about investing in My Hot's Waitress, and I will personally pledge, I name a sum, but you must submit your proposal to Dodson first. Do we have a deal? Paul appears genuinely moved.
You would do that? You'd really do that?
If it means you'll have the freedom to work on your proposal. Paul laughs. I guess we do. And you know that pledge gets you straight into our gold circle of investors. He bites on a nail. Though not our platinum circle. I am happy to stay in the gold circle. It means you don't get the tie pin. I will live with that.